And welcome to this session this morning on Artisan Repertoire, Popular Music, a pair of interesting papers I have been anxiously awaiting. And there's a handout coming around for our first presenter. So I would like to introduce to you Todd Bryant Weeks. He's a jazz historian, writer, and currently a trade unionist, the jazz rep for the American Federation of Musicians Local 802 in New York City. He is the author of Lux in My Corner, The Life and Music of Hot Lips Page, which came out last year and will be receiving a Certificate of Merit from the Awards Committee for Best Writing on Jazz this evening at the awards banquet. He's also lectured at the Institute of Jazz Studies in Newark, at the Louis Armstrong House in Corona, New York, and at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. And he is going to be presenting on one of my favorite authors, actually, Ralph Ellison, and Listening with Ellison, the Ralph Ellison Sound Collection, an overview.
Thank you, Roberta, and thank you very much for having me down here. I haven't been to New Orleans since 2002, and it feels the same, and it's just so great to be here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to speak for about 10 minutes, 10 or 12 minutes, and then I'm just going to hit play, which is, I thought, and that way I can leave if necessary. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Ralph Ellison, his relationship to music, and in particular, his record collection. Four summers ago, I had the distinct thrill of visiting the inner sanctum of one of my literary heroes to attempt what I deemed to be a noble undertaking. I was charged with finding a home for Ralph Ellison's record collection. Now, Ellison, who wrote intelligently and insightfully about music, is best known for two things: winning the National Book Award in 1953, for his shattering novel, Invisible Man, and for suffering the most notorious case of writer's block since Tolstoy. Ellison died in 1994, and he never completed his second novel, which was actually just published posthumously this spring. And that's published 58 years after Ellison began work on it. Now, in the digital age, the rationale underpinning our attempts at preservation of recordings on disc and other gasp dead media is continually under fire. Though one would imagine that in this case, in the case of a world-famous writer who wrote so eloquently about the black experience in America, about its effect on our consciousness as a culture and our shared history, and its relation to our identity, our morality, and our art, one would think that any source material that might provide a clearer view to the inner workings of the man would be a welcome addition to his public archive. One would imagine that that would be a foregone conclusion. Unfortunately, that was not the case here. When I was granted access to the Ellison apartment on Riverside Drive in Manhattan in July of 2006, the collection was slated for the dumpster. And this is a byproduct of the rationale which allows that only original manuscripts, written correspondence, and working notes are of real and lasting value, while commercially available recordings and other artifacts are of a negligible concern when amassing a public archive whose contents will serve future generations of researchers, scholars, and thinkers. Now, without embroiling myself in the politics of the role of the archivist in our society, which is not my intention here, the ethical question remains: what do we keep and what do we throw away? If a collection or a private archive is at all representative of its owner's tastes, values, or experiments with new forms, and if that owner is a person of genius, why wouldn't we set it aside as a body of useful data? Now, the other side of the argument, of course, trumps this reasoning, for in it lies the admission of the possibility that the artist knew very well what they were doing when he or she restricted access. In this scenario, our awareness should be limited to that which has already been published or deemed of lasting value by the artists themselves. And if something is of indeterminate value, it's up to those empowered by the artist to make the choices as to what shall be made available posthumously. Now, I would argue that no literary executor, even if sanctioned by the artist, should have the power to limit the public's view of a great mind. Because in this capacity, absolute judgments tend to render only that which appears absolute in the present. Future generations of writers and researchers will have absorbed and taken for granted that which we have yet to grasp, and will seek more knowledge, more information, more source material. So I say, and my wife will kill me for saying this, but I say, save everything. Now, the Ellison Sound Collection is small. It's only about 500 pieces, but it is now, and I'm happy to say this, ensconced in the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, though it's still in dry storage at this point. Now, for those of you here today who are unfamiliar with Ellison's writing, I have to insist that you rush out of this room immediately, pick up a copy of Invisible Man, lock yourselves in your hotel room, and finish it, okay? For those of you who have some experience with Ralph Ellison, you probably know that his gift was for approaching the chaos and the complexity of the American experience with a vision unparalleled in his day. He possessed a finely tuned ear for dialogue and an eye for characters and situations that, as they unfold in all of their complexity, reveal an inner American landscape that is at once horrifyingly real and confoundingly surreal, gravely serious and hysterically funny. It's a rhetorical lyricism that is both deeply satisfying and also painfully beautiful to comprehend. I first encountered Ralph Ellison in college, but then I found myself face to face with his world when I was researching my bio on Hot Lips Page. Ellison, who was born in Oklahoma City, was always interested in music, and he wanted to be a classical composer. He came up during the emergence of the big band jazz and experienced legendary performers like King Oliver, Ida Cox, Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Walter Page's Blue Devils, Fletcher Henderson, and Count Basie. He experienced them all firsthand. Now, early on, Ralph Ellison recognized music as an important key to self-identity and self-expression. And under the tutelage of Zelia N. Breaux at Frederick Douglass High School in Oklahoma City, he studied harmony, and he played the trumpet in the school band, orchestra, and a brass quartet. As a student of William A. Dawson at Tuskegee, and Hazel Harrison at Tuskegee, he had access to original Prokofiev scores. Later, he was to study composition with Wallingford Rieger in New York City. Now, all of this activity predated his career as a writer, but it informed his thinking. Now, we know this based on an extensive body of essays and interviews in which Ellison discusses music and the emotions that it engendered in him as a young man. As he referred to it, certain needs for other forms of transcendence and identification, which I could only associate with classical music, here citing Schumann, among others, and how those emotions and associations were later folded into his writing. Ellison saw music as a key to the universality of experience and individual expression, and he recognized the influence and impact on his own work of everything from Beethoven to Louis Armstrong. Indeed, Armstrong's 1929 recording of the Waller Razoff Brooks tune, What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue, is an indelible feature of Invisible Man. Now, furthermore, by examining the achievements of many jazz and blues musicians in the context of the Western canon, he broadened the listening audience for these artists and helped to contribute to their stature as artists of real and lasting significance. Now, as historians who deal largely with recordings, we're often engaged with the reconciliation of sound and meaning. When dealing with a collection such as this, so much of that meaning, that pre-existing context, has already been established for us by the writer himself. But one could also argue that it's the very fact that Ellison possessed, for instance, a fine representative sample of the great divas like Jenny Terrell, Joan Sutherland, and Leontine Price, alongside records by the great female blues singers of his day. This lends gravitas to his simply eloquent statement that human anguish is human anguish, and love is love. When he wrote that Bessie Smith singing a good blues may deal with experience as profoundly as T.S. Eliot, who are we to argue? Now, despite the belief that although a writer like Ellison stands on his own two feet by the virtue of his major works, even those left unfinished, and that to insist on the further contextualization of his oeuvre may tend to obscure things, and that in our postmodernist rush to want to define everything based on how it makes us feel, damn it, that we may be selling Ralph Ellison short or seeing him only in the way that we wish to see him. Despite that, I think it's still worthwhile and a lot of fun to know what the man had on his turntable, because it adds to our sense of who he was as a real flesh and blood human being. Page two. A real flesh and blood person with tastes and attitudes and arbitrary capriciousness, just like you and me. And it further humanizes him, partly because the recordings can be re-experienced time and time again in the here and now, experienced in the way that he experienced them and felt in the way that he felt them. So, I may say, if it's Georgia Gibbs or Dusty Fletcher or Alban Berg or Duke and Johnny Hodges or Lips Page and Jimmy Rushing or Pharoah Sanders or Mary Lou Williams or Richard Strauss, if it's part of a pre-existing group, if it exists side by side with other records that are specifically selected because they had a meaning for their owner, commercially available elsewhere or no, then it should remain within that group as part of a collection so that when we're all dead, our children will have something to discuss other than Grand Theft Auto or endless reruns of Glee. Not that those things aren't important, too. What I'm going to do now is, in the spirit of Ralph Ellison, is provide you with about 15 minutes of audio and imagery in a collage that he might refer to as being handmade or mammy-made, and then I'll take some questions if we have time. Any time.
Piña, turu, chua, turu, cua, arme capa tapi, compare gua, piña, piña, turu, chua, turu, cua, arme capa tapi, compare gua.
Porter, I must say yes, sir, to you all the time. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. All my days climbing up a great big mountain of yes, sirs. Rich old white man owns the world. Give me your shoes to shine. Yes, sir, boss. Yes, sir.
Quanto costa questo?
1,000 lire.
È piuttosto caro. Non ha niente di più economico?
Della stessa qualità?
La stessa qualità o qualche cosa di simile?
C'è questo.
Non ha niente altro da farmi vedere?
Meno caro?
Se è possibile.
Forse le piace questo.
Dipende dal prezzo.
elles ne sont pas du tout diphtonguées. 1. A. Le chat. La chatte. Le mâle. Le bal. La valet. Le camarade.
Hikalu, that's Swahili. It means place of gathering. And Hikalu is where black Marines and soldiers meet in Chulai. A barracks where they're free to talk about the man. No officers are present. No whites are present. Only brothers.
Goddamn, no one reading they got us over here because they think we suck because we go out there in the bush. First thing the man gonna say, if Charlie out there sniping, what he gonna...
This is a description of the city of Hue. In the summer of 1966, after the crushing down of the non-violent movement for peace and democracy by tanks and troops of the Teo Ki government.
Duffy bit his button dust. Duffy bit his button dust.
That's it. I ran out of slides. So we have a few minutes. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to try and field them. Kevin.
How many recordings did he have?
About 500 recordings. The large bulk of the collection is 17th to 20th century classical. And about 125 78s, and the vast majority of those are Ellington. Yes?
Did he leave any notations on any of his albums?
If you notice, there's a couple of signed things. There's a Langston Hughes signature. Characterize this briefly. I got a call from somebody close to the law firm that was representing the literary estate, actually Fanny Ellison's estate, and they told me that I had about a day to get in and get out to try and save this stuff, and it ended up being about 2 hours, actually. So I went in with a tape recorder and looked at every item in the collection and read the name of it into a tape recorder, and then brought it home and cataloged it, just basically wrote it up and searched for a home for it. So there's more research that needs to be done.
Yes.
In fact, I collected them myself, although I went into dry storage last week, also for 2 hours, and got some recordings for this presentation and shot some of the LPs. So the LPs are from the collection. The last posthumous work by Ralph Ellison has been released as Juneteenth in 1998 by his literary executor, John Callahan. And then most recently, the complete unedited manuscript of that work has appeared in print for the first time. It's about 1,200 pages. Yeah, definitely the Duke 78's got the most play. And Ellington had a real obsession with Duke Ellington and writes about him extensively. In one particular exchange with Albert Murray, he talks about a young so-called disc jockey coming in to his place up at Bard College and spinning some of the latest bop records for him. And he said he couldn't wait for that kid to get out of there so that he could cleanse the atmosphere with some Duke. So, listen, thank you all very much. Appreciate it.